Yes, we do, Your Honor.
And it looks as if counsel are present and prepared to go. Mr. Myers for the appellate.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court. Andrew Myers for the appellant. We are asking the court to overturn the district court's order based on the district court making clearly erroneous findings of fact and abusing its discretion in entering a sentencing order based on these findings of fact and improperly applying section 3553A factors. Specifically, the court found that the appropriate level offense level was 24 based on a finding that there's a substantial risk of death or serious bodily harm. Pertaining to a harmless error argument that the state makes, alternatively, the court found that the proper offense level would be 20 for endangering a dwelling. It's appellant's position that both of these determinations are improper and that his base offense level should be 10 and then minus 2 to a offense level of 8 for after acceptance of responsibility. The appellant posits that the district court clearly erred in finding a substantial risk of death or serious bodily harm as to the fire that he started. The characterization of this fire when the firefighters arrived on scene was that this fire was low intensity. It was in the Buffalo River National Park adjacent to appellant's grandparents' cabin.
Counsel, doesn't that just mean they got there in time to stop it? What can you show that would indicate that, but for the intervention of the fire fighters, that this fire wouldn't have consumed substantially more than the acreage it did, and there was a dwelling not that distant from the fire that they actually contained?
Correct, Your Honor. The government's witness, though, testified and agreed that this fire had been self-burned out in many areas, that it was cold or dark in several areas. This was a small active flame when the firefighters arrived. And there was no reported wind. The fire was also described as smoldering and creeping, and only approximately 2 feet tall. The flame was 2 feet tall. And this fire was put out with shovels and leaf rakes. Indicating that this was more or less the shovels to cover it, leaf rakes to create a barrier line. The dwelling at issue was across a county road, which in and of itself, I believe, constitutes an artificial barrier similar to what the leaf rakes would have been doing anyway. And so, as it pertains to the endangering of the dwelling,
all of that speculates that the wind conditions and the access of the fire to some additional fuel wouldn't have enabled it to, you know, fire is not entirely a predictable natural phenomena.
Correct, Your Honor. But the testimony at the sentencing hearing was that there was no wind reported. With no wind in a small flame such as this that was put out with leaf rakes, I believe clearly erroneous to assume that the fire is going to jump over a county road to go burn this dwelling. By all accounts,
is there a risk of serious bodily injury here that is also in play? And the reason I ask that is, you know, it's dark. Firefighters are out there under circumstances where it's not easily. People don't see things as well as they might have. And you know, just as an aside, I would just tell you that as a guy who has lived my whole life in a place where prairie fires exist, that they seem to go from 0 to 100 at light speed every once in a while when the wind changes directions. You know, I mean, it's just kind of the way it is. And so, I mean, there's an inherent risk in fire that's always there. Fires are dangerous. But is there anything that we should be particularly concerned about, the fact that these firefighters are out there in the dark under in a remote area and that there is a risk of serious bodily injury or death?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe so. The fire in and of itself, the testimony did not indicate that the fire itself created the substantial risk of harm. It appears that it was more the terrain at issue. However, that would mean that any fire in any national park would inherently carry with this the substantial risk of death. When the evidence that the government witness put on, or the testimony, was that the potential issues pertaining to the substantial risk was falling in a hole, getting stuck on a fence, or falling off bluffs that were defined as 2 foot tall. That's any park, national park, you would presumably go into. And so next to just the terrain at issue, which, mind you, this was not miles down a trail. This was, Your Honor, a few dozen yards off of a county road. And so there's no testimony other than the natural terrain that there was an inherent risk in this that would create a substantial risk of death.
Was any argument ever advanced, like, because I didn't see it in the record, that as to the knowingly created prong of this analysis?
Well, Your Honor, we believe that there was not a substantial risk of death or serious bodily harm. And if there's not a substantial risk, then you cannot knowingly create that. And so I think it's inherent in that.
What are we to make of the defendant's own description? I mean, you gave the description of statements made by the firefighters, but what are we are to make in the record of the defendant's own description of the fire as uncontrolled?
Well, I believe that that can be contextualized in terms of it began as more or less a brush pile. I believe that the testimony of that was about 10 feet wide. It did expand beyond that. But again, by the time the firefighters arrived on scene, it was described as self-burned out. So by the time anyone could have been put in harm's way, this fire was more or less under control of its own volition, or just the natural course of how the fire proceeded. In addition to there being no real testimony or evidence as to the substantial risk of harm other than the terrain, which I don't believe is inherent in and of itself to establish a substantial risk, and the fact that this fire would have had to have grown and jumped the county road with no wind at play, there's not an endangerment of the dwelling. And so we believe it's our position that this enhanced level from 8 to, or from 10 to 24 or to 20 was improper. The second point on appeal is that the court found that the appellant started the fire with the intent to cover up the crime of harvesting timber. However, the facts that were brought out at the hearing were that the National Park Service does not go to this area very often. In fact, it was described as seldom going to this area. And so it makes absolutely no sense as to why appellant would have burned this dead tree after taking the firewood. That could have created this fire or could have notified anyone, when in reality what would have happened if he left it there was that the tree would have decayed and everyone would have been none the wiser. And so as such, there's no evidence that he concealed a crime. The third matter on appeal is that the court improperly applied the 3553A factor specifically as it pertains to our client's criminal history. The court found that he was a criminal history level 6 based on a calculation of 15 points. 9 of those points were for conduct that occurred concurrent with or subsequent to the conduct alleged, or that our client was sentenced pursuant to. We believe those 9 points should not have been calculated, and that he should have had the criminal history point should have been 6 for prior conduct, which we believe that the phrase history in and of itself implies prior conduct, not concurrent or subsequent conduct. When you, based on these calculations with a base offense level of 8 with a category 3 history at 6 criminal history points, our client would have been facing 6 to 12 months rather than the more than the maximum of 60 months that he was sentenced to.
Great. Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Stone?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Lloyd Stone. I represent the United States out of the Western District of Arkansas. Your Honors, I would ask the court to follow up on the court's questions. I think they're correct in this issue, regarding this issue, that the focus here, based on the guideline itself, is not whether or not there was a fortuitous outcome to the fire, rather whether there was a creation of risk. The focus is on the risk. and as this court just recognized in its questions to Mr. Walls' attorney. In this case, the appellant, Mr. Walls, not only set one fire, he set two fires, and then walked away from those fires under conditions, as the court alluded to, that were described in the testimony by the fire chief, that during the day when he set the fires, not necessarily at night when the fires were contained, but during the day when he set those fires, were windy, were dry, were warm, and conditions that the fire chief noted were optimal for a fire to spread. And so in this instance, it's even though there was thankfully no one suffered serious bodily harm, although there was a firefighter who was injured. But the point is, it's the creation of risk. And by creating two fires, by walking away from them on that day, on those conditions, in that terrain, in the middle of a national forest, when the appellant himself lives out there and knows that there is not easy access from a fire department to deal with what he caused. All those things go into the district court's clear findings by preponderance of the evidence that Mr. Walls on that day created substantial risk of serious serious bodily injury or death to those who responded to the fire.
Counsel, how do you address the case law that says that just firefighters doing what firefighters do to go to a fire doesn't necessarily trigger this aggravating factor, that there needs to be some heightened condition that would enable the enhancement? What's the aggravating condition that would make this something different than firefighters doing what they do?
Yes, Your Honor. That is the law. We cited that in our brief, and the district court addressed that issue. The district court made clear, I believe it's page 49 of the transcript, that the district court recognized that it had to find things more than just the mere showing up to a fire. And in this case, the fire chief, Mr. Wimberly, testified very clearly that they would not have engaged a wildfire at night in the National Forest, but for the fact that Mr. Walls' fire was getting close to the structure, the dwelling, called the Indian House in the record, and it had gotten to within 35 yards of that house, so that the firefighters, in fact, had to engage the fire in the evening over that difficult terrain, using only their headlamps. And in fact, the fire chief testified very clearly that they had to do containment lines and so on, all the things that they do in order to engage the fire, because the fire itself had spread to the point that it was endangering that structure, as well as he alluded to the possibility that the fire would engage further structures in that area. So yes, it's true that merely showing up to a fire is not sufficient. But in this case, the district court found, and it's, I believe, assert his findings are supported by the record, that it went beyond simply showing up to actually having to engage it when they would not have otherwise engaged the fire. Your Honor, turning to the second issue Mr. Walls raised, which regards subsection B1 related to his motive in committing the offense. I believe the crux of his argument is that it's illogical. It would have been illogical for him to have burned the logging debris to conceal his illegal logging. But and I don't want to say this. I don't hope this doesn't come across as flippantly. But there's no requirement that his thinking be clear in terms of why he's doing what he's doing. And in fact, there's evidence in this case that Mr. Walls was a methamphetamine user. And in fact, in his allocution, he references that as part of his rationale or part of his mitigation. But there's, aside from his allocution, there's evidence he was on probation for possession of methamphetamine. In the course of conduct, in the days and weeks after this, he was arrested for possession of methamphetamine. So there's no requirement that he'd be thinking clearly. There's obviously sufficient evidence that he, that was at least one of his motives, the motive. The indictment said he was burning logging debris, and by pleading guilty to the indictment, he necessarily admitted the truth of that statement. There were two opinions, one from the fire investigator that saw that there were tree toppings from the large oak tree that were part of the brush pile that he was burning. And so there's ample evidence that Mr. Walls was at least his motive in starting those fires was to burn the, was to conceal that he had been illegally harvesting a very large oak tree, probably over the course of days. And so the focus of that particular enhancement, or that enhancement, is what was he doing at the time, not necessarily the outcome. And again, Mr. Walls, respectfully, I would say, conflates the outcome with what he was doing. At the time, he was trying to cover, to get rid of his logging debris. It happened that because he left the area and created substantial risk of death and serious physical injury, he also thereby eventually alerted others. But that those two kinds of intent don't necessarily conflict. Lastly, Your Honor, with respect to Judge Erickson's question earlier about the knowingly, yes, that's obviously an element. Our position is that if the court looks at Mr. Walls's pre-sentencing pleadings, for example, his objection to the pre-sentence investigation report, his sentencing memorandum, and his argument throughout the testimony, he never raised the issue of knowingly. Thereby, he would have forfeited, which means he would have had the opportunity, of course, on appeal to argue plain error. But in his opening brief, he does not even address the issue of knowingly. And our position is, as we alluded to in our brief, that he has obviously waived or abandoned that issue. And I believe even in his reply brief, he doesn't address it. So that's with respect to the knowingly element. Your Honor, we did raise an argument of harmless error. And we cited the McCarns case out of the Ninth Circuit that seems to indicate that because the guideline range here was ultimately not impacted. Let me preface this by saying if the court finds that the specific offense characteristic, the two-level enhancement for setting the fire with the intent to conceal another offense, if the court finds that that's been sufficiently established, then our position is it's harmless error. Based with respect to the base offense level, based on the district court's statements and findings that the so-called Indian house was in fact endangered. And if the court looks at the subsection lower, the next subsection down from the substantial creation of serious bodily injury, you know, one of the possibilities is whether a structure, a dwelling, or a dwelling other than a structure was, quote, endangered. The natural language of endangered means to put at risk, and there was clear evidence that, and the court alluded to it in its findings, that this structure itself was put at risk. The fire came within 35 yards. I realized that there was a quote county road, but it's not in the sense that we might think of as a road per se. The fire chief testified that it was an overgrown road, and he gave his opinion testimony, which the court obviously credited, that the fire could have easily, quote, spotted over that road by virtue of an ember burning. And you also have evidence that the owners of that house were taking steps to protect their property, protect the structure by virtue of their own actions. And you have the fact that the fire department itself stationed their fire truck, which had water, in front of the Indian house in order to protect it. So, Your Honors, I see that my time is running short. So for all those reasons, we respectfully ask this court to affirm the judgment of the district court in all respects.
Thank you, Mr. Stone.
Thank you.
Mr. Myers, your rebuttal, and please reply to the harmless error suggestion raised by the government. Counsel, you're muted.
Your Honor. Yes, may it please the court. In regards to the harmless error argument, that is implying that there is this, the dwelling that was endangered. We again believe that the facts brought out of the sentencing hearing show that the dwelling was not endangered. The wind, there was no wind when the firefighters arrived. There was a barrier, the artificial barrier. There was a county road that was akin to the types of barriers that they would have, that the firefighters would have been building with these weed breaks. And because there's this barrier, because there's no wind, and because the fire was all of itself burned out, minus a lit flame, whenever the firefighters arrived, there's no evidence that that fire actually presented any danger to the dwelling. There is, as was brought out, there's always a, you know, a minimal risk that harm may occur, but as was brought out, the fire card indicated that there was minimal risk to that guy. Thank
you. And that minimal risk, to the extent that the judge talked about that in the transcript, the sentencing transcript, your argument is that it's clearly erroneous what he was saying? That the dwelling was at risk?
Well, when he found that the dwelling could have been at risk, I do believe that that was clearly erroneous based on the facts that were brought out at the sentencing hearing.
Okay. Did you say there was no wind at the time?
Correct. On the fire card sheet indicated there's no wind. Now, we can't know what the wind was before the firefighters arrived, but when the firefighters arrived, there's a marking of no wind.
Well, I remember as a kid on the farm back in the 40s before weed spray, we used to burn the stubble, and we quickly learned that once a fire starts, it creates its own wind. And this was a county road or a township road, overgrown county road?
Your Honor, it was a county road. The testimony by the government's witness was that it had been overgrown.
Well, I've got some land. Well, anyway, that's neither here nor there. I can visualize an overgrown road.
Mr. Myers, I think I pretty much exhausted your time with my inquiry on harmless error. Was there something else that you had listened to from the government that you felt was crucial for us to be advised of for rebuttal?
Just very quickly, Your Honor, in terms of the aggravating condition, it appears that the aggravating condition next to the terrain is simply that they went to the terrain at night. We don't believe that the timing in terms of nighttime versus daytime is inherent in creating a substantial risk. Again, this is knowing, and so as such, simply showing up at a fire in a national park at night is not in and of itself knowledge that you've created a substantial risk of death or bodily harm to anyone, let alone the responding firefighters. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Myers. Thank you also, Mr. Stone. Court appreciates both counsel's presentations to us this morning and responding to our questions. We'll continue to review the materials that you've submitted and render decision in due course.